This is the Thanks for Sharing podcast, the podcast where we explore all things recovery, healing, and relationship.
Remember to subscribe and download episodes in the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or on the Podbean app.
You can find more Thanks for Sharing at www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/healingpaths. That's path with an S. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Thanks for Sharing. I'm Jackie P.
I'm John T.
We are continuing our episode today, looking at different steps through various big books.
Yep.
And this week we are on step 6.
Yeah.
So that's the good news. We're halfway through the steps.
Well, and I kind of get this sense that, like, I don't know that there's downhill in the steps, but step 6 feels like we've come over the crest of the hill. Mm-hmm. And there's momentum behind you now.
Yeah,
you know,
I feel that way.
I feel like working up to step 6, there's a lot of, like, you've got to dig deep, you've got mm-hmm. to
There's
push.
A lot of climbing.
Yeah, yeah. So, in my opinion, there's a shift in momentum here. Although it doesn't get, I don't think it gets easier. I think the nature of the work changes here.
Yeah, yes.
So what book do you want to start in?
I would say, let's start in the Green Book.
Okay.
SAA. And I don't know what you... had well sometimes in this book we have similar things that
this is always
we are
exciting
sharing.
To me to see if we picked the same thing.
Okay, so in step 6, just FYI, reads, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. That's step 6.
And some other step 6 is read, we're entirely willing to have God
And some of the big books will get into that phrase, entirely ready, and mm-hmm. kind of acknowledge that nobody's entirely ready for anything ever.
Right.
But, you know, we get the spirit of what it's asking for.
Yeah. That's one of the things that struck me about entirely ready in the SAA big book, because most of the sex addicts that I work with don't feel entirely ready to do much of anything.
Exactly.
There's a lot of that other side that's saying, but we could stay this way and it might be easier mm-hmm. and... So
well, and if I'm entirely honest, if I'm practicing rigorous honesty, there's a lot of days where I'm not entirely ready for anything either.
Right? Yeah. So where are you starting out at?
So on page 40, just that second paragraph, halfway through it, it says, for many of us, our problems and shortcomings seem to define us as people. What would we be without them? Often we find that our character defects started as ways to deal with difficult circumstances in childhood or later. It is hard to let go of beliefs and behaviors that once helped us cope or even kept us alive. If we are fearful, we can gently and courageously allow ourselves to consider the possibility of surrendering our familiar defects, trusting that our higher power will not give us more than we can handle. Character defects are undesirable traits, attitudes, and beliefs that make our lives unmanageable, cause pain to others, and block our spiritual growth. Our problems did not begin with our sex addiction, or just add in addiction, nor do they end when we get into recovery. Step 6 builds on the recognition that our malady has roots that run deeper than just our acting out behavior. It requires the willingness to change fundamentally, to be free of the failings that continue to create serious problems in our lives.
So I feel like in that first section that you read, there's something really important there to note, and I think this is something that happens prior to step 6, probably in step 4 and 5. Uh-huh. Where we start to recognize that our defects of character were life rafts for us at one point.
Yes.
We start to feel those very differently. Instead of just being something that we feel shame about, we recognize the role that it played in our uh-huh. life and why
right.
it developed.
Right. And I think in some ways, the shame starts to shift to understanding.
Yeah.
Shame that we had about those defects. Now we start to understand why, like you were saying, that they were life rafts. And we start to just acknowledge it makes sense.
Yeah. So I think noting that developing some compassion for ourselves and developing some knowledge of where those traits came from, that makes this line make sense where it says, these beliefs and behaviors once helped us cope and it's hard to let go mm-hmm. of that. I've noticed with folks that I work with that it seems the more understanding they have of what that behavior caused, it's not like they, you know, clutch it close to their chest and never want to let it go, but mm-hmm. they start recognizing why it's more difficult than just making a choice to let it go.
Yeah.
Because there's, you know, for some people, there's not another way of coping outside of their character
right.
defects.
Well, and one of the things, too, I think that happens with step 6, and we may be getting the inkling that this is happening in steps 4 and 5, But in step six, I think it really starts to broaden this out, that this is not just about the acting out behaviors. Right. So this and so to me, this is where it really takes this shift into this is not just about getting sober. This is not just about stopping behaviors, but this is beginning to transform how we live.
And I think the last paragraph on page 41 really highlights that. And that was kind of the thread that I followed through the big books that I looked at, was that step six is really about larger transformation, not just getting sober. So it says in the last paragraph on the bottom of page 41, as sex addicts, we may find that our character defects take the form of unhealthy beliefs and attitudes about sex. Now, initially, to get and stay sober, I don't think you need to change the attitudes and beliefs about sex.
Right.
I think you need to have boundaries in place.
Right.
So this really starts to take that deeper look. These defects may include believing that sex is inherently bad or wrong, or that sex is incompatible with being religious, spiritual, or quote-unquote good, having difficulty telling the difference between sex and love, or understanding how they relate to each other, having feelings of sexual inadequacy or shame, while avoiding healthy sexual risks, and having feelings of sexual entitlement or associating sex with power and control. If we have been victims of sexual trauma or abuse, we may feel stuck in the role of either victim or perpetrator, repeatedly enacting abusive patterns, or we may avoid sex for fear of being victimized again or becoming perpetrators ourselves. In taking this step, we acknowledge that many of our feelings, thoughts, and patterns around sex are beyond our ability to manage and won't disappear overnight. Our part is to become willing and ready for our higher power to move us toward healthier ways of being with our sexuality.
Yeah, I like that in the SAA big book, again, that's for sex addicts, but it really starts to look at maybe give examples of how those attitudes towards sex that may have come from earlier trauma, different experiences, the family we grew up in, shaped our addiction.
Yeah.
And we can't just stop the behavior without looking at the attitudes that got us into the behavior.
And that's something I've seen come up for folks later on in recovery, like after they develop some stable sobriety. They may, it mentions here, like, being sexual isn't compatible with being spiritual or religious or good. And spirituality or religion or being good, appearing good, may be one of the ways that early on we controlled our sexual behavior. And then we may get to this point in relationships where we start to feel, I want something more, but the line that I'm towing is like I'm moving into being a quote-unquote bad person because
my wants are bad.
And there's a real... sometimes we have to re-examine what, like, footholds and handholds got us to the point that we're at, and really start understanding those differently, because they may not continue our progression. They may keep us pretty tethered to that, I'm just sober, but I'm not relational.
Right, right. And further down on page 42... it says, the readiness in the sixth step is one of the practical results of our third step decision to turn our will and life over to God's care. For our higher power's will to work in our lives, we must be willing to let it work. If we feel that we are not yet willing, we can pray to become ready to have these defects removed. Although there is no perfect, infallible way of knowing that we were entirely ready, we will know when our doubts and reservations are no longer blocking our way. Dropping down further to the on the page, it says, all we have to do is become willing and leave the rest to our higher power. On the other side of every character defect is a character asset. Part of the process of becoming entirely ready is to practice these character assets in our actions and choices instead of our defects. If we suffer from emotional rigidity, we can look for ways to become more flexible. If we are perfectionists, overly self-critical, or impatient, we can practice acceptance. Practicing new ways of behavior can help open our hearts to the spiritual changes God wants for us. And then the last paragraph on page 43 of step six says, as we let go of old ways of approaching life and trust that God will reveal new ways, many of us begin to have a greater vision of what our life in recovery could be. We are ready for real change, and our attention now turns directly to our higher power so that we may ask in all humility for the help we need. It's time for step seven.
I think that's a great segue into the information in A Gentle Path Through the 12 Steps.
Okay.
Because he breaks down working step six and seven into not just you'll do this once with your sponsor, but here's some things that will help you continue to work in the spirit of step six and seven. So he kind of reiterates in here on page 233 that those character traits, the character defects, were things that helped us to survive at one point. He says, some of these shortcomings may have helped you survive in the past, but now they are a gateway to disaster. Several tasks can help you with step 6 and 7. And I, one of the tasks that he lists is affirmations. And I've probably told this story before on the podcast, but when I was in school and people were talking about using affirmations with clients, I was like, yeah, that's what play school therapists do. Like, that's not real therapy. That's Stuart Smalley.
That's baby therapy.
Yeah, that's looking in the mirror and saying, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me. I think really understanding what affirming the self is, that's a really great way, as it talked about in the SAA book, of developing this vision of what life can be. Because I think that helps the willingness. You know, if we're consigned to the reality that our life is always going to be horrible and we never get what we need or want and we're never happy, like, who would want to change?
Right.
So he says, affirmations can help us change our behavior. We can replace unhealthy messages with messages we select. Each affirmation is written in the present as if you are already accomplishing it. Even though it may not be a reality for you today, you need to act as if. In time, telling yourself positive messages will become a familiar habit. Recovery is really a retraining program. It's about learning new ways to relate to ourselves and others. As our attitudes improve, so do our lives. In the past couple months, I was working with my therapist on some insecurities I was having around work and what I was supposed to be doing at work, and how I was supposed to be doing it. And the fear kept coming up that I was going to get it wrong, that I was going to do it wrong. And I was seeing an EMDR therapist, so we were doing EMDR around that. And I connected with these memories. A lot of my work in EMDR went back to memories of when I was like 4, 5, and 6, and particularly around playing soccer four, 5, and 6. And I have this really clear memory at an elementary school in Kaysville where I grew up. There was a lot of dandelions on the field, and I always played fullback because fullbacks didn't have to run, and fullbacks never had to shoot because I wasn't.
Well, if you had a decent enough team, the fullbacks didn't have to do.
We had a great goalie.
Okay,
like I think he went on. He might have played goalie in college for a pretty prestigious team. Like we had a good goalie, so I was safe at fullback. And I remember sitting in the grass and like playing with bugs and dandelions, and I was probably 6 or something. And so in this EMDR session, my memory went back to there. And kind of this realization that the way that I play the game isn't hurting anything. You know, it doesn't matter if the 6-year-old team wins or not. It probably doesn't matter if the 16-year-old team wins or not.
Right.
And kind of this knowledge that my learning isn't hurting anybody. And so I have this set of documents that I review each morning to kind of help me get in the mindset to do the kind of work as a therapist that I want to do. I have a set of documents for the weekend that gets me in the mindset of this is how I rest and relax and recreate. And so I added a page of affirmations to the beginning of that. And the first affirmation was, my learning isn't hurting anybody. It's okay for me to make mistakes and learn from them. And I added that there because at first, it's because I felt like I was supposed to. And after a couple of weeks of repeating that, it really started to sink in and really started to alter how I looked at challenges and how I started facing challenges at work. I was finding that I was a lot less concerned about getting it right and more concerned about, I'm just going to show up and I'm going to try. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
So I think those affirmations can be a really powerful way of becoming willing to try something different.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that I find about affirmations for myself and for clients. I love a good quote. And I have, you know, like in my iPhone on the notes, I have like tons and tons of quotes on different topics. And sometimes I'll get clients who come in with quotes, but quotes are not the same as affirmations. And, you know, the quote may be speaking to something in us, and can we state our, can we get our own statement of affirmation from whatever's speaking to us in that quote? And then, like you were saying, just stating, you know, my learning isn't hurting. Is that what it was?
My learning's not hurting anybody.
Yeah, my learning isn't hurting anybody. Getting that statement out of there really personalizes it. And quotes can be great, but they're not personal. I mean, something's speaking to us, which is why we like the quote. But taking that a step further and personalizing it for our own statement that we need from that, then lands us in an affirmation that can be really powerful for us.
Well, and I think the use of affirmations, like you said, taking it and internalizing it and personalizing it, mm-hmm. that's fertilizer for willingness.
Yes.
Like, I'm willing to do something with this. I'm mm-hmm. willing to try something different. And even if that willingness just starts with, I'll take this vision of what life could be and I'll try to apply it to me.
Yeah.
I'll try to see myself there, yeah. or I'll start to dream. You know, willingness, I don't think is about never being angry again or never fill in the character defect here again. Yeah. It's about, can I imagine a different way of living?
Yeah. Speaking of the term willing, I had told you this the other day. I met with a couple and, you know, he kept saying, I'm willing to do this. I'm willing, willing. And I finally had to just interrupt him and shut him down. And I just said, listen.
Therapeutically, right?
Yes, yes. But it took me a couple of times to get him to stop talking. But I said, I don't know about anybody else in your life, but willing is never a word I would choose to describe you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and his response was, well, but that's because probably most of your clients are just easy. And I said, no, I work with addicts. Like, they're a pretty tough population. I wouldn't say any of them are easy clients. And willingness isn't the same as easy.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, and he was using the term easy like they're just a pushover.
Mm-hmm.
And willingness has nothing to do with being a pushover, right? It's that, I think it comes to that place of knowing, you know, sometimes that when they talk about sick and tired of being sick and tired,
yeah.
right? That leads to some willingness.
Yeah.
Recognizing that what I've been doing isn't working and it hasn't been working for a long time. That leads to some willingness of just saying, I got to be open to something bigger. Yeah.
Well, this is kind of along the lines we talked about with surrender. Surrender is not a passive process, and I don't think willingness is a passive process.
Right.
I think willingness is actually, I'm going to lean in this direction. Uh-huh. That's a hard direction.
Yeah.
And because I'm willing, I'm going to keep leaning into it. It's not that passive doormat, I'm easy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually much more firm than where a lot of our clients come in at when they're not willing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a lot of variableness, and that's a lot of, that got painful or that got real, so I'm going to go in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
Willingness is, we kind of fix a direction and we work consistently at it.
Yeah. I'm going to go along, a lot of times I do, with your gentle path through the 12 steps. We look at the one in the 12 principles. So the principle with step 6 is honesty. And the question is, what must improve? So on page 130 of the 12 principles, he says, everyone has a shadow. It's part of being human. However, each of us has to make a decision about our shadow. We can reach out to it, get to know it, accept it, and learn to work with it, or we can make it our enemy and try to keep it at bay. When we embrace our shadow, it becomes our ally, and it profoundly strengthens our sanity and our recovery. When we treat it as an enemy, however, it forces its way into our life, demanding that it be heard, often creating sabotage or chaos. In a moment of exhaustion or frustration, we suddenly burst out in an embarrassing, over-the-top, out-of-control reaction. If we continue to deny or ignore our shadow, eventually it will start to run our life and we won't even realize it. Then jumping over to page 131, says, when we do a 6th step, we become ready to have God remove all our defects of character. As we practice the 6th principle, we go deeper. We become ready to let go of our defenses against our own shadow. We understand that this is a necessary part of our healing and recovery, and we know that many treasures await us as we explore this hidden territory. Exploring and embracing your shadow isn't a one-time activity, like pulling a tooth or tearing down a fence. It's an evolving process that, once begun, will continue throughout your life. In practicing Principle 6, you'll begin to get to know your shadow. As you practice the remaining 6 principles, you and your shadow will steadily become friends and allies.
It reminds me of a conversation we had a few months ago. I don't think our audience knows this. Jackie's writing a book.
I am.
And so send good thoughts this way.
Yes.
to keep her going on that. But we were talking about the concept of the shadow, and we mm-hmm. were talking about that opening scene of Peter Pan where he's mm-hmm. flying around the nursery trying
yes.
to get his shadow. And I think there's some really beautiful imagery there that's echoed in that book. You know, he catches his shadow and he's sitting there with soap trying to get the soap, which would repel and,
mm-hmm.
and slide, trying to get it to stick. And Wendy sews his shadow mm-hmm. onto him. And I find it interesting that Peter Pan didn't feel complete and knew he wasn't complete without
right.
his shadow being attached.
Yes, even though his shadow was mischievous,
mm-hmm.
he knew he needed his shadow.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like that concept of kind of embracing our dark side, mm-hmm. and noting that that's a part of us. We can't be this one-dimensional being that's all light. There's light and dark.
Right.
That's how those forces exist.
Yes. Okay, what do you got next?
12 steps and 12 traditions. So I kind of jumped around in this one a bit. I thought it was interesting in the opening paragraph on page 63. It talks about separating the men from the boys. And I'm not going to read this because I think with most things, original text, AA, it's very, very sexist. and I think those images of what it takes to be a real man can sometimes be destructive. But it did talk about how we work on becoming capable of willingness to honestly try repeatedly step six. And I thought that was an interesting take on it, that step six isn't that one-time thing. It's something that we work over and over again, mm-hmm. that we become willing over and over again. And it also was talking about how there can be debate on whether or not God will actually remove character defects for you, or if that's the thorn in your side, to use the New Testament phrase, that you just have to have. And I remember a realization that I came to in my own recovery, that the God I believed in wasn't a greedy God, and he wasn't going to reach into my life and take something that I wasn't aware of. But anything that I became aware of and cultivated and got curious about and asked for help on and presented, my God was willing to take and hold things that I gave to him, but not anything that I held back. So I'm going to start reading on page 64. And this kind of furthers that idea that step six really starts the post-sobriety work. It says, having been granted a perfect release from alcoholism, why then shouldn't we be able to achieve, by the same means, a perfect release from every other difficulty or defect? This is a riddle of our existence, the full answer to which may be only in the mind of God. Nevertheless, at least a part of this answer is apparent to us. So we can apply the steps to other problems that we have, and that's where recognizing the defects of character comes in. On page 65, it says, it is nowhere evident, at least in this life, that our Creator expects us to fully eliminate our instinctual drive. This kind of goes back to the SAA book about beliefs around sexuality. So as far as we know, there is nowhere on record that God has completely removed from any human being all his natural drives. Since most of us are born with an abundance of natural desires, it isn't strange that we often let these far exceed their intended purpose. I like that idea of getting to know our character defects and getting to know our shadow side and knowing the application for it, and when we've overused that.
Right.
It says, when they drive us blindly or we willfully demand that they supply us with more satisfactions or pleasures than are possible or due to us, that is the point at which we depart from the degree of perfection that God wishes for us here on earth. That is the measure of our character defects. So I really like that concept of a character defect isn't a specific thing. You know, like I've had to work a lot on anger and what anger has meant for me. And one of the things I've come to realize is that anger is not something that I want to push completely away from me. It's more of this continuum. There's parts of the spectrum of anger that I would say are character defects, and there's parts of the spectrum that are gifts.
Yes.
And it's kind of knowing when it's pushed beyond that intended
use. And that's where I think, you know, making friends with our shadow becomes so important, because there are qualities of our shadow that we need.
Yeah.
Right? So that, like, part of your anger may be there in the shadow, or anger may be considered a shadow trait. And yet there are times where our anger requires us to speak up. And we need to speak up, right? And so we might have to pull from our shadow in order to not be this nice guy that makes everybody, that's kind to everybody, right? But that I can also speak up and be a force to be reckoned with. And that comes from that shadow. When you were reading that, it also reminded me, and we've had this conversation before, that, you know, with a lot of our character defects, they may start with our character assets, but they've just been dialed up so much. We've overused that character asset that it's now become defective.
Or even dialed it down, I think, the other end of the spectrum, too. Like when we, like in my case, when I have tried to lose the ability to be angry, I'm a big victim. And it's poor me, and everybody does this to me. And so the other end of the extreme, where everybody's stupid and I'm the right person, and all of that. So I think that overuse and underuse of the asset is where we find the defects of character.
And step six and seven really get us to start tuning into finding that balance between mm-hmm. underusing and overusing mm-hmm. and trying to land somewhere in the middle where it's an asset for us.
And I think that makes it so much more usable when we can realize that, I liked what it said in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, that they can't find anywhere where God expects us to eliminate mm-hmm. the natural parts of us.
Right.
I think that that's a really helpful way to approach step six, that it's not, okay, I've got to make my list and now here's the new line to tell.
Right.
It's, I'm willing to take a look at these and I'm willing to uh-huh. move these.
Because we have to remember that perfectionism is also a defect.
Right.
So this isn't about, step six is about becoming perfect, because that would be our defective thinking.
This can get real circular.
Yes. I'm going to move to the Essanon book on page 63. We worked against ourselves in many detrimental ways in the past. First, we tried to remove the character defects of the sexaholic. Then we tried to remove our own hurt and rage, but our attempts were futile. We begin to realize that only a higher power can do the job. God will certainly remove our defects and shortcomings if we ask Him. In the past, our understanding of such words as giving, helping, and loving had become confused. We gave, helped, and loved others only in an effort to change or manipulate them. Our love was conditional. We expected a return on our investment. In turn, we blamed others for not giving us what we expected. Our ulterior motives for loving were hidden, even from ourselves. We did not know how to express our own feelings and needs to others. We did not know how to be responsible for our own happiness. We tried to use the sexaholic to make us happy instead of developing our understanding of God's presence with us or within us. Becoming entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character is one of the most beneficial processes we will go through in our lifetime. But it doesn't mean all our defects will be lifted out instantly. Some might go right away. Others will go in time. Still, other defects will improve with patient adherence to the principles of our program. We always want to aim for the best, even though we know we cannot be perfect. We accept ourselves as we travel at our own pace towards spiritual growth. In the same way that no one is perfect, no one is ever entirely ready. All we can do is try, but that is a vast improvement over saying, I will never give up these defects. Maybe we said that in another way, such as, I know I'm right. Short of refusing to give them up, most of us have to admit that we have loved our defects. They were our defenses against the world, and they served us well from time to time. After all, weren't some of our manipulations the only methods we knew to get what we wanted?
Hmm.
It takes a brave person to step unarmed into the arena of the unknown, desiring only to relate to God and others with honesty and intimacy for the first time. We must admit the old ways haven't worked very well. We are now ready to let them go. We can now look for reassurance to this Al-Anon wisdom. God does not remove a fault to produce a vacuum, but to make room for one of His ideas, love, kindness, and tolerance.
I like that image of stripping away the armor of the defects.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how we experience it as armor, and it becomes a point where it's a block to right. other people and to God.
Well, and I remember, you know, reading this one of the times, the first times I read this, where it was, you know, talking about how, you know, the resistance to step six is saying, like, I'm never going to give up these defects, and mm-hmm. thinking to myself, like, well, why would I want to give up my defects? Right? But when it says this in this book, maybe we said that in another way, such as, I know I'm right. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I say that. I never say, I'm not going to give up my defects. But at the time, I was like, I do like to be right.
Right.
So I might need to look at that.
I think one of the most fundamental qualities of life is growth.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're doing that, I'm right, we're really, I think, pushing against that fundamental direction of growth and improvement, mm-hmm. saying nothing needs to change
yes.
here. I'm fine.
Well, I remember talking to my girls a couple, maybe it was just a year or so ago, and we were talking about this idea of being right and, you know, saying to them, if we think it's another way of saying, like, I have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the brain works, if we're saying, I know it, like, I'm sure this is it, I know, then what we're signaling to the brain is its job is done.
We stop seeking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was encouraging them. I said, never, never stop asking questions. Never think you have all the answers. Because the minute that you do, your growth stops and you'll die a little bit, right? So we always have to be open to new ideas and new ways of thinking about things and asking new questions. And I think it really does help keep the brain from deteriorating.
Well, and I think that that saying, okay, I've got the answers, here's what I need to do, like that's what addiction was. I found this panacea, I found this cure-all for whatever I'm facing.
It's a rigid way of living.
Yeah, and you notice what came out of that. You know, if you're an addict in recovery, you know how far that got you.
Right.
So why would it make a lot of sense to continue in recovery saying, okay, now I've got it, and now I'm there. But it's a really, I think it's a really tempting place to be, because as much as we are beings built to grow, I think there's some parts of us that just want to hunker down and be okay for it. Like, we have to balance our need for growth with our need for security.
Yeah.
And I think to grow in big ways, we have to let go of some of our security.
Mm-hmm. And certainty does feel secure, right? When we say, I know this, I've got this, I have it all figured out, certainty feels secure until we start to realize that it's getting in the way of growth.
Yeah.
It's getting in the way of further evolvement.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got that essay book and the Al-Anon book, and then we'll get into ACA, which we apparently love to close with.
That's our dessert book.
It is. Okay, in SA, the white book, I'm going to go to page 117. It talks about an ongoing process. It says, in recovery, we find that steps 6 and 7, once taken, become a continuing process. And we'll talk a little bit next week as we get into step 7, kind of as how we work step 6 congruently with step 7. And rather than being a matter of eradication of the impulses to think or do wrong, it is freedom from their power over us, one temptation at a time. The defect itself may remain, but we no longer have to obey it. When we surrender the impulse and cast ourselves onto God each time it shows its ugly head, we receive the power to be free of it, and gradually the impulses themselves get fewer and farther between. Healing. And then further down it says, some of us may experience sudden release from some defects, but for most of us, there is one practical way to overcome our wrongs that has never failed. We surrender them up to God, and we practice making them right. After all, how much practice did it take to burn these sick patterns into our brains and souls? If we have a habit of lying or fudging the truth, we undo it by correcting the lie with the person involved. If we're resentful or hostile, we undo it by going to the person affected and admitting where we've been wrong. Where the other party is not overtly affected, we overcome the resentment by surrendering it and praying for that person. Or we may find we even have to tell that person about it to break its power over us, provided it doesn't injure them or others.
It reminds me of what Karn says about there's only a degree or two of difference between an addict and a really successful creative person. The brain almost works the same way with a few important differences.
Yeah.
How much practice did it take to burn these sick patterns into our brains and souls? I think that there was a point in addiction where we became willing to escape at all costs, even if that cost was the proverbial deal with the devil, and we're selling our soul for that. So I think that the mirror to that in recovery is we become willing to repair, and we become willing to make amends at all costs.
Right.
We move that momentum in the other direction, no matter what it takes.
Right.
And that's exactly, like, that's the process the brain went through to get into addiction, and it's the process the brain goes through to get out of addiction.
Yes. That at times, you know, we sell our soul to the devil in order to stay alive, but at some point we realize that is no life.
Yeah.
And then we have to start working these steps to really gain back a meaningful life.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Al-Anon, I'm going to page 55. In step 6, we learn to let go and let God. This means that we must once again learn to trust the God of our understanding to do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. It isn't always easy, because we know too much to remain comfortable with our defects. As we catch ourselves acting them out, we don't like what we see. We want to be proud of ourselves and feel at peace with our behavior, yet we are increasingly embarrassed at what we find ourselves saying and doing. These actions, attitudes, and habits do not reflect the person we are striving to become. At this point, many of us try once more to change ourselves. For instance, if we have always been too busy focusing on everyone else's problems while ignoring our own, we might try to force ourselves to mind our own business. We are often dismayed at how quickly our efforts fail. Although enormous energy does go into focusing on ourselves, many of us find that we continue to be preoccupied with other people's lives. Sometimes, we have to try to make these changes on our own and fail. before we can honestly say we are entirely ready for God's help, after a lifetime of self-sufficiency, most of us need to be reminded that there are limits to what we can achieve without help. Paradoxically, by accepting our limitations, we can avail ourselves of unlimited possibilities. With God's help, we can overcome seemingly impossible obstacles. Miracles can grace our lives, and serenity can take the place of despair. Our defects of character can be blessings in disguise, because in order to be free of them, we must deepen our faith, and that spiritual depth will bless our lives. Our strength lies in accepting our role in our relationship with God and trusting that a higher power will play a significant role as well. No longer must we struggle alone, attempting the impossible. We need only let go and let God.
You know, that section that you just read, I think that would be a good point for our listeners to go back and rewind and identify the things in there that speak to you. Mm-hmm. That's a great place to mine for affirmations. Here's the vision of where I want to go mm-hmm. with this. That's talking about a lot of those promises mm-hmm. of step six.
Well, and I think, you know, it's one of the things I had to realize is I had a lot of excuses as to why I wasn't getting to where I wanted to go. And it had to be with, well, if they would do this or she would stop that, then I could do this, right? And we find ourselves trying to mind our own business and go where we want to go and mine our own vision. And then we find ourselves preoccupied with what everyone else is doing, mm-hmm. right? And it reminds me of that, referring to Carver, I think we bring up his name in every episode. We should give him royalties.
No. Right. he wouldn't take them.
But, you know, Carver one time was talking about his wife who, you know, had worked the Al-Anon steps and she knew not to be codependent in behaviors. And as he was, you know, coming home one day and he was grumpy and irritable and, you know, just his character defects were all over the place, being unmanageable. And, you know, she said to him, would you like a glass of water? Are you thirsty? Can I get you a glass of water? And he was like, no. And she was like, are you hungry? Can I get you a sandwich? And he was like, no. And she was like, all right, let me know if you want to talk, right? And just kind of like, I'm willing to give you water, I'm willing to give you food, but above that, you've got to take care of yourself,
right?
And I'm not going to be preoccupied in your life to make me happy,
mm-hmm.
which I think is the brilliance of any of the Al-Anon fellowships, is really looking at how we codependently take care of our relationships mm-hmm. in order to meet our needs.
Yeah. So diving into the big book of ACA, the part about step six from ACA that I really appreciate the unique view on is the difference between the survival traits mm-hmm. and the character defects.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read a little bit about that. So it says our survival traits.
What page are you on?
This is on page 209.
Okay.
Our survival traits include people-pleasing, addictiveness, hypervigilance, and stuffing our feelings to avoid conflict or arguments. We often confuse love with pity and tend to love those we can rescue. Even though we've identified such traits in step four, we still are new at this. We need focus to find our best course of action for release. Many adult children take the path of removal for character defects and take the path of integration for the survival traits. So we start to differentiate here. If it's a survival trait, we want to integrate mm-hmm. it. If mm-hmm. it's a character defect, we want to remove it. And I love how their litmus test for character defects versus survival traits. It says there's a key distinction between defects of character and survival traits of the laundry list. Adult children readily identify with the survival traits. However, they struggle claiming defects of character. Most adult children willingly admit to being people pleasers or fearing authority figures, but balk at claims of being judgmental, dishonest, or jealous. And I've seen this in the rooms of recovery. I brought this to the rooms of mm-hmm. recovery. You know, we talk about character defects, and it can almost turn into this contest. Survival traits.
Right.
It can almost turn into this context. Well, let me tell you about how big of a people pleaser I am.
Yeah.
And then when we talk about, you know, being judgmental or dishonest, we get these very principled stands on, well, my parents were very dishonest
right.
and I would never do
yeah.
that. Or my parents were so judgmental. And
because
I would never
oftentimes
do that.
The character defects are what we recognize in our parents.
Right.
And so how could that be us? Right.
Right.
But adult children become their parents.
Yeah.
So, yeah, whereas the survival traits are traits that came about because we were in dysfunctional families. And
yeah.
so we readily recognize those and can identify with those. But the other ones...
And distance ourselves
yes.
from those. Yeah.
But the other ones, when we're like, oh, that's my parent, that's not me.
Yeah. Continuing on, it says, adult children tend to feel relief when reading the laundry list traits because they realize they are not unique in actions or thought, which I think is really important.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big part of step five. They often feel shame or dread when hearing the list of defects of character. These are the distinguishing points between the defects of character and the survival traits developed as children.
Yeah, I had that part underlined, and so I won't obviously go over that. But jumping over to page 212, in the second paragraph it says, adult children dread emotional pain because we rarely had anyone to stand with us as we experienced anguish as children. Growing up in a dysfunctional home, we often endured unspeakable suffering in silence. We became hypervigilant to emotional pain and sought addiction, work, sex, or drugs to stay pain-free. Many of us have writhed on the floor with codependent pain. However, pain is different in ACA. We now have friends and a higher power to rely on. We are not alone. Our experience reveals that there is value in emotional pain. With support and with gentleness, we can find our healthy pain and its healing release. Just as we reclaimed our tears before we arrived at ACA, our tears seemed unproductive, so many of us had stopped crying. Through step work or counseling, we reclaim our tears and their value. And then over on 213 under Entirely Ready, it says, upon completing step 5, we return home and find a quiet place to reflect upon what we are doing with our lives. We are on a path of self-honesty and self-forgiveness that will lead us to a new way of life. We are also moving away from our victim, perpetrator, and authority figure roles. We learned in step 4 that our survival traits have an opposite that we have practiced as well. If we feared authority figures, we often became an authority figure who was feared, either as a parent, supervisor, or other positions in life. If we judged ourselves without mercy, we also judged others just as harshly. We have been victims, but many of us have also been perpetrators. If we have gossiped maliciously, we stop. We become willing to ask our higher power to help us forgive ourselves and to change. We are reparenting ourselves as we grieve a lost childhood. Then over on page 215, it says, by now, we have stopped punishing ourselves. We are asking God, as we understand God, to help us become entirely ready to have these defects of character removed. We must realize that good intentions do not work in removing our defects of character. Likewise, willpower or self-determination is no match for these flaws in our thinking and reacting. We need help from a power greater than ourselves to achieve step 6 results. We sit in a relaxed position, but we concentrate on becoming entirely willing to have our character defects removed. When we are ready, we repeat the 7th step prayer for each defect or survival trait we wish to have removed or integrated. As we prepare to say the 7th step prayer, we review our possible defects of character and survival traits. So, yeah, just like that focus on really kind of how we do that.
Mm-hmm.
And as we sit down and we can calm that body and say the prayer to remove it, which is step 7.
Well, and there's a real, in working step 6, I think there's a real immersion in the character mm-hmm. defects, not like getting lost in the shame, but like walking through that neighborhood frequently mm-hmm. and knowing mm-hmm. what it looks like and knowing what it feels like. The more time I spend honestly looking at my defects, I think the more willing I become to let them go, because I'm realizing what those actually are
mm-hmm.
and what they actually do, instead of telling myself a story about, I'm just to the point, I don't sugarcoat things, instead of realizing like I'm abrasive,
right.
Or that I, am not compassionate.
Uh-huh. Well, and it's easier to ask and receive feedback from others who are helping us in this process mm-hmm. because it's not so shocking when they give us that feedback. We know.
Yeah.
And we are wanting to know when that comes up so that we can be aware of it.
Yeah. So we would like to thank you for listening and remind you that your story matters. Remember, there's something meaningful in every chapter. Don't wait to share your story until it's finished.
You can share your story with us on our Facebook page, Healing Paths, Inc., or on our website, www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com.
This podcast is solely for the purpose of information and entertainment and does not constitute therapy, nor should it replace competent professional help.
At the end of another episode, we want to remind you that nobody has time for perfection. We are pursuing progress.
Remember the prayer of the perfectionist. Help me remember I can't do it all. Help me to take things one step at a time, and that the only step I need to focus on is the next right step for me.
Help me to remember that life is a journey. Help me to be able to separate all that I'm learning from all that I have to do. Help me to remember that I am not alone, that I can ask for help. Help me to strive for frequent awakenings, not mastery. I am enough. Amen.